So Nehemiah chapter 1. I'm going to preach on the last few verses of the passage, but I'm going to read from the beginning to give us a bit of context. So Nehemiah was a Jewish man who's got a very special job. He's the cupbearer to the king of Persia. Nehemiah chapter 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. It came to pass in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. So it was, when I heard these things, that I sat down and wept, and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven, and I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you, and observe your commandments, please, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night. For the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sin of the children of Israel, which we've sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you, and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember, I pray, the word you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest part of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. Now, these are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, I pray, please, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And let your servant prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. For I was the king's cupbearer. Now, God willing, the next time we're here, we might look at chapter 2. And he goes into the most powerful man of the empire and say, would you mind if I leave my job and go back to Jerusalem? Well, before we do that, let's just consider again this prayer of Nehemiah. It's hard to pray. Nehemiah teaches us a few things, not only about how to pray, but about the good news of the gospel. Now, Nehemiah is an Old Testament saint. He lived a few hundred years before Jesus came back. He did not know Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Romans, Revelation. He didn't know all of that. He knew some of it, but not all of it. So we know more than he did. And yet he also understands something of what we call the gospel. Gospel is not primarily a style of music. It's not primarily a style of church. It's from an old English word, which means good news. I think I'm in the mood for a bit of good news. Because there's plenty of bad news about. In fact, it's never in short supply, is it? This is good news. And Nehemiah knows something of the good news, the gospel, that we call Christianity. So, let me look in a bit more detail. Verse 9. So this is Nehemiah paraphrasing what the Lord said to Moses in the first 5 books of the Bible. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, Though some of you were cast out to the farthest parts of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. But if you return to me, God is not a place. There are places you can return to. I know people who go to the same place for their holiday year on year. I'd get bored of it. They like the regularity of it. They like seeing the same thing. Okay, so you can return to that place. How do we return to God? When God originally designed the human race, he designed us to have fellowship, friendship with him. That's what we're made for. That's why so many folk are miserable. They've got lovely houses and they've got jobs and they've got holidays, but they come back and deep down they're still miserable because the one thing for which they were made, to have fellowship with God, they lack. So when you seek God, when you become a Christian, when you try and find him out, you are, as it were, returning to him. And here, Nehemiah is quoting the Lord to Moses saying, return to me. He's not telling them to go to a temple or to go to a synagogue or even a particular city. Well, that is the immediate reference. But rather, return to me. It might be some of them have been worshipping foreign gods. In which case, the message is, leave them behind and return to me. It might just be that these people are incredibly busy. There's so much going on. Return to me. Come back to where you belong. We're living in times in which very few people know the Bible. So let's go back 100 years. Even if people weren't converted Christians or went to church or chapel, chances are they went to Sunday school and they knew the stories. Nowadays, it's basically Jonah and the whale. And possibly the prodigal son. It's still such a powerful parable that the Lord told. There's still a knowledge of it. If what I've just said is true, I don't need to give you a detailed explanation of it. But suffice to say, a young man leaves behind his father, squanders a whole load of money, ends up in a pigsty, and comes back. And he says, well, you know, I'll become a hired man. I'll become a farm labourer. I'll be better off as your farm labourer than in a pigsty in that strange country. The father, of course, is embracing him, and the fatted calf meets its end, a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. He's welcomed back as a son. He doesn't deserve it. But that's a picture of God's grace. Grace means the undeserved favour of God. And that ne'er-do-well, that wastrel, that no-hoper, he returned to his father. And his father loved to have him back. The God who speaks through Nehemiah also speaks to us. Return to me. But I've been wallowing in a pigsty. Return to me. But I've got so much on. Return to me. But I've done X, Y, and Z. Return to me. So the first thing he says is return to him. Keep my commandments and do them. Returning to God is not simply to believe that he is real. Even the devil has never resorted to atheism. He believes in God. Much good it did him. No, the purpose of the Bible is not to try and convince you to believe in God. In fact, as far as I can tell, the Bible makes very little effort to convince anybody that there is a God. It simply tells you that there is one, and you accept it. So to return to God is not to simply believe that he's there, but to seek him, to desire him, to believe he will reward those who diligently seek him. But when we find God, when we come to him through Jesus Christ, we then want to obey him. We want to live for him. If he becomes our king, our ruler, our master, it means we now do what he wants and not what we want. Our world is characterized by a whole load of people doing what they want. And look what good it does them. There's some irony that when you determine to obey God, you're the most happy. When you determine to obey him, it's then that you're most free. So not only are they to return to him, but they're to keep his commandments. A misconception of the Christian gospel is that, like all the other world religions, it's simply a list of rules for you to follow. Do this, do that, do the other. And having kept all those rules, you might just be good enough. That is not the message of the Bible. That is the opposite of the message of the Bible. The message of the Bible is that we cannot be good enough for God. Our lives can never reach his standard. And even when we can muster righteous deeds, according to Isaiah, they are like filthy rags to God, because they make us feel that we are good. No. When you return to God, you want to obey him out of love and not to buy his favour. His favour is not for sale. And if it were, we couldn't afford it. I remember passing a jewellery shop in one of the posh arcades in Leeds, and I'd bought my first house in Padiham at the time, and I saw a ring for sale in that jeweller's which cost more than my house.
Did you buy it?
I did not buy it. I could have sold my house and I still wouldn't have been able to buy it. And if I did, it wouldn't have kept me dry when it rained. So no, I did not. And in one respect, there'd have been little advantage in going in and attempting to buy it, because it was out of my league. Imagine the glories of heaven. Even if they were for sale, you couldn't afford it. Spiritually speaking, you're broke. That is why God, who loves you, says, then come in for free. Not because it's cheap, but because my son has purchased it on your behalf. He went to the cross, satisfying my wrath, paying the price in full, so all now may enter in. But having entered in, or knowing that we're going there, we now want to live a life which is pleasing to him. This idea of being saved by grace and not by works, in other words, saved by God's favour rather than us doing lots of good things. Some people have looked at that and thought, well, that means you can live how you want. If I don't have to go on pilgrimages, if I don't have to give a certain amount of money away, if I don't need to pray a certain number of times every day, I could just live as I want. I could do all sorts of evil. But if you've really received the grace of God into your heart, if you've truly returned to him, you will want to live a life that pleases him. If you don't, it's because you never returned to him. Which is why he says, let them return to me and keep my commandments and do them. He says, though some of you were cast out to the farthest parts of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there. Two interesting things about that verse. The first one is, could they really be that far away? We're talking about the Jewish people here. Now what happens is that the Jewish people were living in a land called Judah. But God had warned them that if they keep going after foreign gods, he will chuck them out of their land. He will exile them. And that is exactly what happened. And that is why Nehemiah is writing from the Persian Empire and not from Jerusalem. Not here anyway. And so they were scattered throughout Babylonia, throughout Persia. Maybe some got to India, maybe some got to Europe. But if they come back to the Lord, he'll bring them back. But what is the chance of those Jews getting into ancient spaceships and zooming off to foreign planets? It's not literally true, is it? And yet in one respect, if you wander away from God, it probably feels like you are in the furthest part of the heavens. If you're, imagine that there's a husband and a wife and they love each other so much, but, you know, one of them has to go away for work for a week. It's galling to the one left behind. Oh, it's coming back, pull yourself together. It doesn't quite feel like that. Here the Lord is saying, no matter how far you've gone, no matter how far you've wandered, no matter how distant that pigsty, if you desire to return to me, I'll bring you back. And the second interesting thing, the text begins with, if you return to me, still in verse 9, but then says, I will gather them from there and bring them. So who's doing the returning? Are they returning themselves, or is the Lord bringing them? Well, the message is return to the Lord. And yet, it's God's own grace at work in your heart, which brings you back. You might want to be right with God, have a desire to know God, to love him, to be saved by him, but actually it's God himself who's bringing you back. It's God himself who's working in your heart. It's God himself who inspired you to come today. Verse 10 says, now, these are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. I love that word, redeemed. It has an everyday meaning. If someone gives you a voucher, you redeem it. It means you take it to the shop or whichever brand is on it, and you hand it over if it's a real piece of paper in a real shop, and they will give you goods according to that value. You've redeemed it. You've bought it back. Value was given to them. You're now claiming it back. To redeem. We might talk about people redeeming themselves. Somebody's done something wrong, but they turn up the next day with a big bunch of flowers. That may or may not work. But we might describe them as having redeemed themselves. They've tried to put it right. The Bible's use of that word is far richer and far deeper. It means to buy back, to bring back that which was lost. Interestingly, the ancient world would have been very familiar with the idea of redeeming people. Back then, if you got yourself into debt, or you were on the wrong side of a war that happened to lose, you would be captured and enslaved. And your labour and your body would belong to another. You were a servant, but you would never get paid. Imagine somebody gets into debt and they are sold to pay for that debt. They are enslaved. That enslaved person can do nothing to redeem themselves. This is why. From the moment they were enslaved, everything they owned, every money they earned, belonged to their owner, not to them. So if they do a bit of moonlighting on the side, get a bit of pocket money, they cannot use that legally to buy themselves back. It's not their money. Because nobody can redeem himself. That's why Nehemiah says, whom you have redeemed. The message of the Bible is that God, through Jesus Christ upon the cross and from that empty tomb, has redeemed people. He has bought them back. We were lost. We were sold. We were captured. But Christ paid a price to bring us back, to set us free, to give us back our dignity, our freedom, our hope, and our future. Redemption involves a price. Let's imagine that we are living in the ancient world and one of our relatives or one of our number has got himself into debt. There he is on the auction block. People would club together, each put in a few denarii, and hopefully there's enough there to go to that auction and buy him back. Now, if somebody wants him more than you do, they will offer more and you might not have the funds, but hopefully, if you can take somebody from that slave market and buy them and set them free, you have redeemed them. The Bible sometimes speaks about the blood of Jesus Christ shed upon the cross as making a payment. The means by which we are bought back. The means by which we are set free. The Bible says, you have been bought with a price. We humans value each other too cheaply. That's why there are people on the other side of the planet working in sweatshops so we can have cheap clothes. That's why probably a few miles away, unborn children are dying. That's why old folk are dying alone. Because we don't value human life. But God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. The most precious thing, the most expensive commodity, the dearest currency, the life of God was spent that you might be brought back, was spent that you might return, was spent that you might have a right relationship with God. So when the Bible speaks of redeeming and redemption, it's looking forward to that time when Jesus Christ, God himself, would hang upon a cross that all who believe in him might be redeemed. I'll deal with verse 11, I think, another week, because practically speaking, Nehemiah is going to try and find a way to help rebuild physical Jerusalem. And yet in this wonderfully rich prayer, which we briefly considered, we have the theme of returning, being brought, redemption. Let's just spend a few moments thinking about that, then I'll pray, and then we'll sing.